when the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain, and you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
Hi, I'm Mark Laren Young, and welcome to the Tyee Podcast. George Bowring is a poet, a novelist, an editor, an educator, a historian, and a national treasure. He's published more than 80 books. He's Canada's first parliamentary poet laureate. So what else would anyone want to talk to him about but his work in the BC Forest Services in the 1950s? Something he's never been interviewed about before. I met George at his home in Vancouver to talk trees.
It was amazing. I had been in the Air Force. I came out of the Air Force. I went and took a year of university, and it wasn't exactly where I belonged at that time, although later on it would be. I joined the BC Forest Service. This was in 1958, you know, when I was four.
Nice.
And I was hired as a marker. At where I went to was an area that later on became the subject of a couple of my novels, the area around south of Kamloops, around Merritt and Kamloops and Ashcroft and that whole area. And we're technically in the Merritt Forest Service area. What did they call it? It wasn't called a region. I can't remember exactly. And so we lived in a bunkhouse in Merritt, and I was on a crew with two other guys, a guy named Jeremy, who was a great big, huge, heavy Englishman with a German dog who used to eat raw hamburger and beat their living Jesus out of me one time when we all got drunk, so much so that we broke the stove.
Okay.
And another guy, now his name was Jeremy Crow, and I can't remember the other guy's name, although he was a guy that you would expect would be a Steve. And so the marker's job was, this was in the interior in British Columbia in the late 50s. And we had heard about a thing called clear cutting, which some Americans did in California or somewhere. We thought, what a bizarre, savage animal thing to, not an animal thing. It's a horrible human thing to do. Would be like to cut down all the trees in some areas. I can't believe it, right? Because what our job was we walked around the forest. We never said forest. Walked around the hills, the bush, with a big can of yellow paint, usually, sometimes blue, sometimes red, sometimes white, but usually yellow paint on our backs, with a hose that came from that, and a gun in your hand. And you would walk around and mark the trees that they weren't allowed to cut, the logging companies. And what you would do is, you would mark right around where the tree meets the ground at the bottom, so that they can't, so if there's a stump, you'll still be able to see that, right?
Okay.
And then an X or something like that on the tree, about eye level. And you mark the trees, and sometimes that thing around the bottom was, in the wintertime, it was got a little bit dicey, because you'd be walking around in snowshoes, and you'd make this thing, on the edge of the snow, but then the snow would disappear, and you'd find out you had another, 4 feet of tree. and what we did was, we would mark the trees that we thought would be the best parents for the next batch of trees that were to grow. That is to say, if it was a tree that was a schoolmarm, i.e., you know what a schoolmarm is?
No.
It starts off with one trunk and breaks into two trunks and goes up like a big letter Y sort of thing. They can cut those. They don't want them really all that much, but they can cut those. You don't want them because they will leave cones that will grow more schoolmarms, right? So you look for the best trees you got in a sale. A sale was like an area of trees that they had bought the rights to cut in that area. And the trees that were at the tops of the hills, because if the trees at the crest of the hill, that means that the cones would fall from the tree and then roll down a certain distance and regrow that whole area, right? So a lot different attitude, and one that has a completely different sense of time than the whole thing of clear cutting and then sending in a bunch of dope using kids to plant trees. Because when those dope kids go in to plant trees, they plant, you get an area that's however many hectares or something, of all the same tree. The trees that all look the same and they're all the same height and they're all the same thrive in, so on and so forth, and they don't have that, like, citizenship that goes with various other kinds of trees and various other kinds of bushes and so forth growing in that area, which you will get if you do it the way we said you're supposed to do it and did it. So anyway, that was my job. And then part of the time, I was... And sometimes we'd go up in a tent, the three of us, and we'd be up there, like, for a week working up a mountainside. Sometimes we'd be so close by that we would... Our vehicle, we'd spend in our bunkhouse. And then part of the time I was another job, I was allowed to do another job when they needed somebody to do the most unpleasant part of it. What the heck you were called? We're called a marker and I had it in the middle of my head just a second ago. It's the guys that go out and survey. Once the outfit, the logging killers, the tree killers have got the rights to cut these trees, you go and tell them how much wood there is in that lot and that sale, that you're going to tell them in board feet or in something other. And so you go out and you measure the whole thing, and then you check the kind of trees there are, of all the different varieties there are, and you tell them when they go in there how many million board feet of lumber there are in that thing, right? And it involves a couple of guys, one guy at the front of this long, long, long chain, the guy at the back of the long, long, long chain, first of all, surveying the outlines of this place. And I was always, like, the guy at the front of the chain, and you had to go straight. Like, if you came to, a little stone canyon, you couldn't go around it.
Okay.
You had to go, like, through it and so forth. And then you went in and you did all these calculations and found out how many things there. Well, 1958, after I had been there for a couple of months, became, up till then, the worst ever forest fire season in Canada, in both BC and Quebec. And in Quebec, for instance, the smoke from the forest fires in Quebec was found in Northern Europe, hovering over, like,
Wow. Islands
and stuff, right? And ours, we had one fire that was way up on the Yukon border that had, the last I heard, had done like a million acres. And they said they wouldn't fight it. They would just wait until winter and let the winter put it out. Because he couldn't get in there to fight it, right? And it was too big to fight anyway. So he just had to let these, an area that the size of Utah or something burn down. But we had the worst. And so I was in the Meredith region. And we had so many fires that we couldn't... Cruising, that was the other thing you do. You go cruising and then you go marking. I was cruising for the BC government.
Nice, I like that.
and so we couldn't afford to have anybody doing that anymore. Everybody had to be involved in the firefighting thing. Now, in those days, nowadays, there are professional firefighters. They'll import them from Saskatchewan or Ontario to fight fires in BC, right? And these guys making lots of money, big salaries. In those days, you had to get volunteers, and they got paid like hardly anything, like just a bit above zero, right?
Okay.
Except they got a lot of free food and so forth. But they had to fight fires for like 17 hours a day. So here's how you recruited them, how you got them to volunteer. You drove a forest fire van around, for a BC forest thing van around to the back door of the pub. And then the rangers in full uniform went in the front door of the pub. Now they knew that you were a suppression crew. That is to say, they were going to get volunteered. So they would like run like crazy for the back door and the windows, and there the biggest guys in the Forest Service would be to grab them and throw them in the van. It was really neat.
These were serious volunteers then. These were dedicated.
Yeah, absolutely. All they wanted to do was fight fire and not drink beer. So I had to, The way it worked was that the fire, the boss guy in your region, wherever it was, the warden or whatever he was, he could arrest people. He had the power to arrest like a cop does, right? So that's how they could get around this. They could say, wait a minute, all right, this is kidnapping, isn't it? No, it's not kidnapping. I've got the right to, etc. So we did that. So the job I had was lovely. All our vehicles were in use. There were fires all over the place, and there were suppression camps up there fighting these fires all over the place. And on the top of just about every mountain, there was a fire going on. And so we had to rent. Our vehicles were all in use, so we had to go and get rent vehicles from everybody else who had vehicles that could do the mountains. And the vehicle I was assigned was beautiful. It was a yellow, the smallest Land Rover you can get. It was bright yellow, and it said, and it had pictures of chainsaws all on all sides and the roof, because it belonged to the McCullough Chainsaw Company. This was really neat. You know Pat Lane, the poet?
Yeah.
He's from the North Okanagan. One day over at El Purdy's place a couple years ago, we were in the kitchen. And I said, Pat, you know the McCullough Chainsaw song, don't you? And he said, I sure do. And we stood there and we sang the whole McCullough Chainsaw song for the audience of El Purdy. You know, they go, you're in luck when you got a McCullough Chainsaw. You got power by the hour in your hand. With McCulloch, you're the master, because you keep on cutting faster. You're in luck when you got a McCullough Chainsaw. And I used to sing this as I was driving this vehicle around. So my job was to go every day to the Safeway or the Super Value or whatever the heck it was and load up with, I had a big shopping list that I got the day before from the fire crew that I was supplying. And I would go in and I'd buy all this stuff and get them and load this thing up and get the Vancouver newspaper, the most recent newspaper, which was probably published the night before, and drive halfway to the fireplace, go off into the bush for a little while and read the paper, right, and have a bottle of pop and so on and so forth, and then come back and go up to the fire crew and give them all the stuff that I bought, and then they would give me the list for the next day, and off I would go. And it was, like, really fun because I was not a very experienced driver. I was just, like, a cocky young fella. And it was really neat. You go up a mountain road, a logging road, and if a logging truck was coming down that road, the road was only wide enough for the logging truck. So you had to shove your thing into reverse and go and as fast as you could go because the logging truck's coming down with his brakes on, water coming out from underneath him and so forth. And you had to go as fast as you could and find a place to turn around.
Now,
in reverse. It's wonderful.
I know how small those logging truck roads are. How did you not end up killing yourself?
I don't know. But as you're driving up this road, you're looking all the time at places that will be possible to get off the road. So you know where they are, right? As you're coming back and you choose amongst them, like the one that's like over the chasm or the one that's like on an angle on the hill on the other side of you. And away you go. That was a wonderful job.
How long did you do this?
Oh, until next time I decided to go back to university.
Okay.
And it was, oh yeah, I was going to tell you about one time. I don't know anything about cars, right? And one time, this little Land Rover that I'm driving along, singing the McCullough song, there's a leak in the radiator, so I had to carry several buckets of water with me to fill up the radiator, and because I would be driving along there and outdoors, it's like 90 degrees Fahrenheit, right? And so you have to keep filling up the radiator. It was horrible. Like you had to have a rag to hold the rag to go, ow, to get the lid off the radiator, right? Fill it full of water. And I would fill it, when I was in town, I'd just fill it from a tap. But when you're up at the fire thing, you just fill it from the lake. So you'd just dip all these big pails in the lake and have them in your car as you're driving along down the hill. And I had to fill up the radiator, so I'd open up the radiator and fill it full of water and everything. And then when I got to the bottom, the next time I filled it up, I noticed that there were a whole pile of little dead fish, little boiled fish, inside the radiator of the McCullough chainsaw vehicle. I hope that they appreciated that later on when McCullough got it back. That was my fish story. But I didn't eat any of them. They were only like fingerlings, right?
Okay.
Fellas. And you couldn't, like, really reach in and pluck them out.
Yeah.
You just hope that someday somebody would solve that problem, or the fish would just, like, boil into nothing.
Do you remember when clear-cutting came to BC? You were saying that clear-cutting
I remember being astonished when I saw it actually happening. I think I must have heard about it in the 60s. Must have been. And the first, I didn't see it, and except in the States. I saw it in California, saw it in Oregon, I saw it in Washington, and I thought, oh my God, what are they doing? I couldn't believe, Now, there are clear-cut people, logging people, who are interested in the bottom line and all that stuff, who say that that's the most economical way of quote, harvesting, unquote.
Yes.
Logs, right? That any other way you do it is not as... It's not as time thoughtful, but it strikes me as well. I mean, you've seen when you're around a place like Vancouver, or if you're on the side of if you're on a heavily used forest road, you don't see as many clear cuts. But if you're flying over them, they can't hide them on you. They can't tell the pilot not to fly over the clear cuts. But they are clearly ashamed of them, or feels if they're doing something criminal, quote criminal, that's to say they're probably not, they probably got a brother.
Well, we do a really nice job of making sure the fringes next to the highways look really good in this province.
The first time I saw that was in the Redwoods.
Okay.
In California, driving through the Redwood Forest. These gigantic cathedral of trees and so forth. I have to go and have a leak. Pull off the side of the road, go in among the trees, and they're not there anymore. There's just like there's just like a couple rows of trees on both sides of the highway, and then like no trees.
So it's like a Hollywood facade they've got.
Yeah. And then inside there's that. You know what it looks like after they've done a clear-cut logging? You look and you just see all these, the scrap. Like, they don't clean up. They just say, oh, well, you know, 7,000 years, it'll dissolve. It'll somehow rot and become part of like the ecoculture.
Nice.
Hideous and awful. And then I began to see it in BC. And I thought, I could not. Like, the first time ever, there is, I don't know what it does to the human heart, but if you grew up in Oliver like I did, there's a great big huge open cut on the face where they're getting out this, what is this, this white stone that they like for some reason or another. Silica. They've been cutting silica there for decades. And it's just hideous. Like, it's, when you get to the South Okanagan and you see all that dry brown and those few scant trees and the cactus and so forth, it's the landscape that the creator of everything finally came to and understood was like what he meant all along, right? That was like the landscape. And so if you come and you just blast open the side of a hill, like that's a sacrilegious thing to do. Like, it's like somehow or another, you know when you're looking at it that it's wrong. That it's just, not only is it ugly, like, I don't believe that, you know, that that Oscar Wilde, when they asked him about good and bad, about morality, he says, well, I just want to know whether it's a good poem or whether it's a good setter, right?
Yeah.
That ain't the way it works. There is a relationship between beauty and good. There's got to be. Although, when I think about some of the women... No! And so when you see clear cuts, it's that way too. And that's why people hide them. And I think maybe one of the reasons they hide them is because they have friends in the tourist industry. And the tourist industry says, we'd lose a few tourist dollars. You heard that phrase before?
Yes, tourist dollars. It's a pretty
yeah, if they had to drive along. That, there is a one sense we could say, you know, we should be giving them a kind of education about our economy and tell them and let the tourists know that this is the smell that the old, like when you hear those pulp mills, that is, as somebody said, I think it might have been W.A.C. Bennett, says the smell of progress. or was it the smell of good times or profit or something like that, right? It's like,
that sounds very W.A.C. Bennett.
Yeah.
Now, you've written the history of BC, and it's why I thought to interview you for this.
Yeah.
Are there any moments...
I didn't know anything, you know. It was all a lie.
I love that. Okay, I bought it all, too.
I'm a novelist. Come on.
It was the swashbuckling history of BC. Yeah. Are there any swashbucklers who stand up for you in the history of BC logging? The Gordon Gibson? Are there people like that who you go, wow, I can't believe they did what they did, or...
Ginger Goodwin's the only guy that really stands up for... I think it would be a good idea to, I don't know, like to change the names of some of the areas of Vancouver Island. Vancouver Island is a wonderful situation. Like, it's so open baldly there as a piece of geography that isn't at the same time a piece of history about how a lot of rich people hired a lot of people that never stood a chance of getting rich to rip holes in the ground to get coal out and to rip down the sides of mountains to get logs out. It's probably the best image of that we've got in the whole of Canada.
Now, one thing that I wonder about, and this comes from what you're saying there, why do you have a sense of why BC is so polarized? Why, I mean, just politically, there's nowhere else like this province
in Oregon terms is. Of. I remember Oregon when I was a kid. Oregon sent a left wing, almost socialist in American terms, senator to the Senate, but elected right-wing conservative, or let's say conservative government to run the state house. And BC is like that too, right? It's like we've got, the government is either, actually there's two possible governments in BC. There's the CCF-NDP, the social real.
Yes.
And the anti-CCF-NDP, whatever name they choose for the time being.
Yes.
As I say, it's really hard to tell. Like if you, like right now in BC, the anti-CCF NDP government party is the Liberals, who had zero seats like 20 years ago, because in those days they were called social credit. And we don't know whether they were going to then be called, like they did the similar thing in Alberta, they changed the name of social credit to conservative. And in BC, they changed the name of social credit to Liberal. But I can't imagine if you're, say, a Liberal in Ontario, you would have the same politics as Gordon Campbell's cabinet in BC. I don't think so. I think Gordon Campbell's cabinet in BC is a little bit more like the Conservative cabinet in Alberta, would seem to me. Except that maybe, I don't know whether the premier of Alberta's ever read a book. Maybe the new one has. I don't know. But no, the guy, like, oh, there are all, there's a, in BC there are, usually in any given year, 27,000 local histories and autobiographies published by small presses and no presses at all in British Columbia about people who grew up in the logging industry. Right? And they'll either be about people who ran small-time logging outfits. I know a guy who runs a logging outfit of one. He's he just drives it around various parts of the interior of BC and cuts down a few trees and hauls them off and sells them to whoever, Weyerhaeuser, whoever does them. And so you can't call them popular histories. They're sort of unknown histories. They're the kind of things that BC Book World loves. You know, the BC Book World paper, Alan Twigg, he loves self-published books, and he loves the whole fact of BC being full of authors who have written about how they grew up in the Cariboo and went down to the newspaper office and paid the guy to publish the damn book, right? He loves those things. They're all over the place. But I don't remember. And there are obviously biographies of the captains of industry, whether they're like mining people or logging people or whatever people. And they'll usually get written by somebody paid to write them.
Okay.
But my only hero is Ginger Goodwin. Well, Ginger Goodwin was a British guy. He was like a communist. Well, he was a socialist. He was like, he wasn't a wobbly, but he was a wobbly-ish person who spent some time up around Trail organizing miners up there, and came down to Vancouver and was helping organize miners to he had a bit of a problem because he was working in the Comox Valley where the people running the show wait a minute, why am I talking about him? He was in mining. He wasn't
exactly. but I was reading in your book that the loggers also went on strike when Ginger Goodwin was killed.
That's right.
He was assassinated.
Yeah. That the mining people, the the people who were the mining, the miners were almost all foreigners. I don't know whether the loggers were or not. Like, most of the miners were foreigners. They were either Welsh or British or Chinese or...
Now, you were saying, you were telling me earlier, most of your, or you had a lot of family members who worked in logging. Can you talk a little bit?
My brother has just retired, and he's, the poor guy. He worked for the last 30 years sharpening knives for Weyerhausen in OK Falls.
Sharpening knives.
Sharpening knives, yeah.
Okay, tell me about the knives.
They got these, like, long logs that are not all that thick. And I think what they made in that mine was like 2x4s to sell in the U.S. or somewhere. And he referred to it as my brother always referred to it. Everybody up there referred to it as tree murdering. So they have the first thing they do is they got to take the bark off these logs, right? So they have this big machine that goes like you shove these. You have these big. You have a kind of a. It looks like a. It's like a. It's a, sort of like a tunnel. It's kind of like an MRI machine, right?
Only
longer. And you shove these logs go through, and there are these knives that spin around and just rip the bark off the trees. So my kid brother's job was to go in every once in a while and take out the knives that weren't sharp enough and put in like new sharpened ones that he sharpened in his little sharpening place. But he had to go into this tunnel, which say in Okanagan Falls, say it's like 40 degrees outside, that means inside that tunnel it's like 60 degrees, right? And so what a horrible job it is. Oh God, it's a dreadful job. The poor guy has to go and get these knives out of there and then come back, come out, put the new knives in and come out and then sharpen these knives and everything and then sit and read a book for 4 hours.
Okay.
But now Weyerhausen's closing down. Just after he retires, Weyerhausen's closing down and given like a whole money to people, depending like a buyout of these workers, depending on how long you've been working there. Now my kid brother's been working there for like 30 some odd years, right? So he figured it out. He was going to get 70,000, but he retired a couple of months too early before he found this out.
Oh, ouch!
Yeah, but on the other hand, he was supposed to retire the year before. Like early retirement.
Okay.
But he stayed because of some big medical bills or something he has, or some medical insurance business, so forth, because he has a couple of medical problems and everything. So he stayed up until late summer, the beginning of the fall, or something like that. And then he found out if he'd stayed for another few more months when they announced that they were closing the place down, he would have cleaned up. But so he's taking it. And but I've told him, what if you had to subtract all those hours when he was just sitting reading a book, which is probably printed on paper that came from Weyerhausen?
Okay.
Then, yep. And I have a... So that's... And so next door to him lives my other brother, who really doesn't do any work, but who has a guy who stays with him, who's the guy who runs this little one-man sawmill. Then my late wife's brother-in-law, sister's husband, he's a scaler, and so he was in the logging business like all his life, and because we're dealing with the whole Comox Valley, Cumberland sort of thing and so forth. And then her cousin is living on an unnamed island, growing dope, on a place where there used to be a lot of logging, but there isn't logging anymore because like this... Well, there's a little bit of logging still goes on, but it's the big family logging industry that it was at one time because that's been depleted. So you have to have other crops. So he has other crops that he moves around from time to time and tries to keep them in the shade of other crops so they're not all that visible from above where the helicopters run by the war on you-know-what are flying.
All right, then. Now,
that's got nothing to do with logging, does it? Well, it has to do with the fact that loggers have to supplement their income, right?
Yeah.
Or they have to put themselves in a space where they can stand being towards the latter part of a life in logging.
How do you feel about trees?
I hug them every chance I get. No, they're just like ripped down. They took, you know how they come in, they rip down a house in like an hour or so. So like two doors to the left of us is this house they just ripped down last week. And they just like, they put the little protective thing around the trees that belong to the city that live outside the sidewalk. But the trees that were on that property, they just like ripped them down, just tore them out, just ripped them up, right? Just like chunks of them lying around. And I think I'm a pretty typical BC person, though. I feel just, it just bothers me. It just hurts me when I see something like that happen. I remember I used to get so mad when there used to be two things that prairie people did when they came to BC. One was they drove extremely slowly right over the yellow line in the middle of the highway, right? It's when you were behind them. And the other one was they would buy a retirement home, and then they would like cut down every tree in that place so they could see farther, like i.e. so they could see across the street to the other guy's trees. And we felt just like people in BC just feel terrible about that. Look how every time, this is the only place I know where there's headlines if somebody gets in trouble for cutting down a tree. Or remember that there was a story last year about this woman who wanted her view to be better.
So oh yes,
in an English Bay, so she poisoned the trees that belonged to the city across the street from her. She slowly poisoned them,
and then she had to go into hiding.
Yeah, right. Because people were really mad. Right. Look how upset people. One of the biggest news books from the last couple of years ago was the one about that sacred albino tree up there in northern
BC. The golden spruce.
Yeah, nobody even knows quite exactly where it is, right? But boy, that was like in Canadian terms, kind of a bestseller book, right?
Yeah.
And much rewarded. I'm a like a typical BC person that way. I used to when I was a kid, I used to just think how heroic those guys looked in the ancient pictures of people killing trees. And then I realized, you know, they're similar to another picture. If you look back at pictures from, say, the 1890s, 1910s, you see pictures of guys standing there all over BC in all the little towns like Kamloops or wherever it is, and you see them standing there over like this desolate landscape, one of the most desolate. There's a picture of New Westminster when it was first, you know, de-treed, and you could see these people standing over the fallen trees like they were their victors, right? Their foot on the. They reminded me of the Bible picture I had of the picture in my Bible of Goliath lying there on the ground and David standing there with one foot over his chest, brandishing his little slingshot, saying, right, I took care of this guy. So you would see that picture in of the guys who were the victors over the loggers, like that. And I used to hear that expression, he battled nature, or he had a fight against nature, or something like that going on. And then you would also see pictures, I mean, Roy Keoka, the great BC artist, poet, and painter, and so forth, had his dad was a guy from Japan, worked on the whaling business up there in Prince Rupert. And you look and there's the pictures of these guys who have, like, conquered a whale. And there's that. It's exactly the same thing. Like, instead of, like, dead trees lying on the ground, it's a dead whale lying on the ground with these human beings standing over and saying, we did it! We've reached some kind of acme of human possibility. Right? Knock these trees down. So you get these guys, these images of these guys with these gigantic cross-cut saws, one guy at each end putting the saw in a tree that was unfortunate enough to be the size of a house. And they've sawed the thing, and they're standing there looking like heroic gentlemen, right? Awful. It's like the guys fighting the dragon. What was the dragon? What was a dragon? Like, why was it so important to show that a human being could defeat a dragon, or a tree, or a whale, or a grizzly bear, right? Or I saw a picture today, an early picture today. It was in the Oliver Chronicle this week. They always have a picture from the olden days. Show these guys driving this 1920s, 30s, 20s car into what would become Oliver. And the car, and there's a bunch of guys standing there looking heroic. And there's the head of a moose on each side of the front of the car, right? Like with these big horns and everything. I don't know where the rest of the moose is, but there's two heads on the front of this car, and they're saying, look what we did.
If somebody
I'll go out there, God, and kill you a moose.
If somebody put you in charge of the BC Forest tomorrow, what would you do?
I'd say, let's have a hiatus. Let's find it. I got a... My friend David Cull, who was one of the Tisch poets, used to be a poet. Now he lives in a little hillside town in Italy, but he's been all over the world finding ways to build houses that you don't have to knock down a bunch of trees to do. He built a house in the Kootenays out of rubber tires. He used rubber tires. If I was put in charge... I guess I would designate authority here and there, but I would, like, if you had to have a bunch of people running the forest region of, say, the Northeast, I'd say I'd put in a forester and a poet, and they'd have to work it out together.
I like that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was George Bowring. Coming up on future podcasts, longtime logger and labor leader Wade Fisher, the president and CEO of the Forest Stewardship Council of Canada, Anthony Marcel, and the director of Garbage Warrior, Oliver Hodge. For the Tai'i Podcast, I'm Mark Larniak.